Cliff Noble, 3rd of November 1994 at Alexandria. Thanks for talking to me, Mr. Noble.
Well, I was born in the street in which I live 75 years ago. My grandmother built this place in about 1908, and I've lived in the area because of the participation that I have with the local community. My father was an identity in the area. He was originally a plumber on the railway, and when Mr. McKell became the Governor General, left this seat vacant, my father won the seat. And he was an alderman at the Alexandria Council. And he had a tremendous affinity with the local people. Just to give you an indication, on one occasion, one of our local Irish people, who I'll talk about later because the area was predominantly Irish, this fellow got into trouble for an indiscretion. He used to drive a horse and cart, a tip wagon to be effect, and you could do anything to him but don't touch his horse. The local police had the misfortune to touch his horse, and they had the misfortune to him because he was very good with fisticuffs and finished up getting 3 months in jail. Now, as a consequence of that, he had about six or seven children, and my father and a couple of others used to go around every Friday night to the hotels, collect money so that that family would not be embarrassed. But in all that time, they looked after him. And he was, this particular chap used to like the Amber Ale quite a lot. And when he'd start to play up, the door would be a knock on the door, his wife would be here. My father was the only one who could handle him. And he used to make him go up and sign the pledge. Being Irish and being Catholic, the pledge was a very significant document. And he used to bind my father to silence, not to tell anybody that he'd signed the pledge, as if they wouldn't know from drinking, you know, copious amounts of grog. All of a sudden he was off the grog for a period, and he never ever broke that pledge, and he made many of them from 3 to 6 months. And this was the sort of thing that happened. Like,
what period are you talking about?
I'm talking about the period from about 1913 onwards. That's when it would be. My father was married around about 1910. I am the last of three boys, and we've lived in the area all that period of time.
So you've lived on Copeland Street?
Copeland Street.
And you were, what year were you born in?
1918. So I'm 75 at present time. And my real love of the area was brought about because as a child, there was all this sharing, caring, participation. If anybody in the street, there was a disability, was sickness, so the neighbours would come in, they would do the work, they would cook the meals, they would do the washing. And sometimes they didn't even like the people, but it was just what it had to be done. And my recollection of the area, like, because nobody had anything, you know, as soon as you come home from school, the first thing, get your shoes off. And you get it. And I must have been clumsy because I was always kicking the tops off my toes. And you know, these lovely Irish women, they were short, you know, short and dumpy with ample bosoms. And they would grab you up and rest you on there and talk to you and soothe all your cares away. And this is the sort of thing that happened with them. And it's always been thus. As I say, I tell you, like, in terms of, just to give you an illustration, in 1908, the government doing today what they done years ago, there was no funding for the medical dispersion, and they had what they call the Redfern Dispensary. Now, this Redfern Dispensary was closed in 1908, and a chap by the name of, he finished up, Sir Joynton Smith, he called a public meeting, had got his business associates and the local community, and they decided that we need a hospital. And this is how South Sydney Hospital was born. And it was brought about by the fact that everything was made gratis to them. A chap by the name of Cooper, who had really owned more than half the area and half of the Waterloo and a big portion of Waterloo. And he was really a fine man. He made the donation of 2 acres for the South Sydney Hospital to be built on. He promised them £500, which was a tremendous lot of money in that time, for the first patient that went in. And then we got £500 from what was known as Syrian Town. Syrian Town was the other side of Redfern Oval. They were all the Arabs and the Lebanese and the Greeks, and they used to wear the great flowing robes. They were a participant. And then the Chinese community gave £90. Now, wherever they got it, because if ever you heard of man's inhumanity to man, it was brought about by these particular people who they got the Chinese out and they worked 365 days a year from daylight to dark in their market gardens. Their reward was to be fed, and on their demise, their ashes would be sent back to China. And so these are the sort of things. I talk about multiculturalism today. It's always been here. We had Syrian Town, and there's a little area between Redfern and Waterloo which was known as Irish Town. Now, you only had to be Catholic and you had to be good producers of children to keep the faith going. And then, of course, the Chinese. Now, the Chinese used to operate most of the market gardens. But getting a little ahead of my story, because it goes back to about 1823 when the first distribution of land grant was made. Now, this was happening, a fellow by the name of Hutchison got 1,400 acres, and this Cooper come in and he bought it. Now, you would not know the area, but over there on the adjacent, what they call Henderson Road, a chap by the name of King was granted 10 acres to grow wheat. Can you imagine wheat being grown in Alexandria? So, and most of the streets that you see around here, Hyle Street was a market gardener, and they went all around the place with these market gardens. And and of course, the poor old Chinese, as I say, they work from daylight to dark. And we as children used to really torment them, because I remember, I suppose I got three good hidings in my life, and one was for going over, pinching their vegetables, and brought them home very proudly. And when I put them down, my father said, "Where did you get them?" I said, "I pinched them off the chinks." And he gave me chinks. He said, "Don't you know that those poor fellows work from daylight to dark, and you go over there and just steal their vegetables and bring them home? Now, I'm going to make an example of you," and he did. Now, other things that we done to those poor Chinese, they had a great big fat draft horse. He could hardly fit in the shafts, and the only things that he knew was going from the market gardens down to the city markets. And on the way back, invariably the poor old Chinese, by fatigue, would go to sleep. And we, doing the wrong thing, would turn the horse around and he'd go back to the markets. These were the sort of things that happened. And on one occasion, a poor old, they call him in those days, Charlie. He got home, the horse was outside the slip rails, so we got in, looked down the slip rails, put the horse the other side the slip rails and put the rails back and threw little stones at him to wake him up. I don't know what he said, but he must have called us for everything because he went like a berserk. He couldn't make out how the horse got one side of the rails and the cart was the other. So we've done all these silly, stupid, awful things to people. And of course, if you go around the district, there was a Joss house over there. And on one occasion, it's a rather interesting sort of situation because some of them got buried, the wealthy ones got buried over here at Botany. And a couple of smart alecks was over there one day. And of course, at their Chinese funerals, they put copious amounts of food on the grave. And a couple of smarties said, "Hey, Charlie, when's your mate coming up to eat the food?" And Charlie, very collectively, says, "The same time as your mate's coming up to smell the flowers." So you've got all these little incidents that happen. And so this is what Alexandria is all about. Yeah.
Whereabouts were the Chinese farms that you're talking about?
The Chinese farms went all over the other side of McAvoy Street in that area, because this was where the offspin for this Shays Creek, it was known, finished up being known as Alexandria Creek. But this had always had arable land, the market gardens were there. The water used to come down from what they call Hungry Hill up there at Mount Carmel. And coming down through the sand hills, it got cleansed and it all used to empty down to that sort of thing. And here's, not too many people know about environment, but this was a mecca, an oasis in an area down here. And when the industry came, that's when Shays Creek started to get, you know, out of pot, because all the discharge was going into there. The fish went, and of course, the business, where I told you, like, in a 4 square miles, because of the fact that we would start from this, what was described as a pleasant rural village, become this great big industrial complex. There were 550 factories in a 4 square mile area around here. Now, we didn't have any trouble getting labour, because at that time, an ex-premier, or ex-prime minister, rather, of Australia, was a relative of a chap who lived up there, at Redfern. He ran a carrying thing called named Buddy McMahon. Now, Buddy McMahon was a good, kind person. He would bring out these poor, great, big Irish people, strong backs and weak minds. He would dust them in with the horses to work out their fee for bringing them out. And as his business progressed, he soon got to the stage where they had to start bringing out some Irish colonies. And this was how Irish Town got created, up there in this area between Redfern and Waterloo. And there were some great characters up there.
Can you, who were some of the people around there at Irish Town?
Well, one of the ones that come to light the most thing was a chap by the name of Barney Fallon, who ran the Zetland Hotel. He was one of my father's best mates. He went into that pub from the proceeds of what we used to call a sixpenny double. He had no money to pay staff, and my mother and father used to go over there and pull beer for them, till somebody rang the railway up and told them my father had a second job, and that was true. They got nothing. It was just something they had to do. But his mother was a character, because being Irish, one of their real facilities was to have a wake if somebody died. You go right? And what happened, Mrs. Fallon had the job of laying them out. And of course, at a wake, if you've never been to one, the Irish people, they'd have the coffin in that one room, and the corpse would be in his best pyjamas and his hair had all been cut, and he would be getting ready for one for the road. And they used to have a dish of salt on his chest. They'd be drinking all the grog about the place, having pickled onions and dipping them in there. And on this particular occasion, there was a chap by the name of Martin O'Shaughnessy. He was down in the corner and he was crying, "Oh, Paddy, what am I going to do without you? You've been my best mate." We had our punch-ups, but we were always good, mate. And he kept drinking, and then he started getting melancholy. And he says, "How's Martin going to get across the River Jordan?" And he said, "I know." And it was in the era of depression. He got out 10 shillings and put it up in his pyjama pocket up here, which was a tremendous amount of money in those days. But Mrs. Fallon, times were tough. Mrs. Fallon seen where he put it. So at the appropriate time, she took the 10 shilling note out and put a note in, "I'll pay you when I get there, Mary Fallon." So you've got all this sort of situation. They're supposed to be stupid Irish, but this was the first part of the lay-by system.
And were you there at that occasion?
No, my dad was in that this sort of thing.
And he told you these stories?
He told me about all these sort of things. The same as, you know, when the transport come here. We had a famous line called the Bow Bells, in which there was horse-drawn buses. Now, he had a place around here, and you could go from Alexandria to Wynyard for tuppence. And that went for years. It was very successful. And just up there in Mitchell Road now, there's still the stables. They had 84 horses up there. And when the trams come into the area and push them out, well, they were very upset naturally. So what they used to do, when they found the timetables of the bus, they used to go around with the horse-drawn buses and pick up the people before the trams could get them, which caused all sorts of difficulties. And my father told me that he played football in the area, and he went over to Balmain in these double-decker horse-drawn buses. And if they happened to beat Balmain, he said they were always sent off with a cascade of stones. They chased the buses and pelted them with stones. And so all these sort of things have a very, very big impact on you.
Yes. You know, before we were talking about the Chinese,
yes.
Did you know the names of any of those Chinese?
No, I don't know any, but there would be some people who would probably know them. They used to have only a handful of people who controlled all of them. They bought the market gardens and had these fellas working for them. One name comes very, very, kind of mind. a fellow by the name of Vic Lasue. He was one of them. He was quite a good man too.
And were the owners of these market gardens, were they Chinese?
Oh, yes, yes. Oh. See, the same as over here, the things now. I tell you, talk about industrial matters. My first job, and this was way back in 1934, they applied for an apprentice for the boot trade down here on the corner. So I went down, and there were 60 other kids there, all after one job. Fortunately for me, the local plumber was doing some work there, asked me what I was doing. I told him I was applying for the job. So he went inside, seen the proprietor, and they come out and they picked me. Well, it was great. The only problem was I was then up in my best. I had a 2 and 6 penny pair of patent leather shoes that had cardboard soles on them. And everywhere that I walked in the place, the tacks were going through these cardboard soles. And I was jumping all over the place. And of course, being new and being Catholic, I never knew much about language. And they were using filthy language all the time. I used to put my hands over my ears so I wouldn't hear it. And then, of course, it got to the stage where I said one day, if my mother was down here, she'd wash your mouth out with soapy water. Well, you can imagine what they did to me after that. And then they start calling the Pope all sorts of names, and I wanted to fight everybody. And I couldn't beat Dad Drew. I was never any good fighting.
How old were you then?
I was 14. And this was all the sort of things that happened. And you talk about, like, industrial matter. This was a disgraceful sort of thing because down here we had a lot of people coming from the outer suburbs, Bankstown, Canterbury, that come down here. Now, all the seniors got sacked at Christmas for 12 months and had to reapply for their job. And then during the day, if there were no orders, they'd have to come down and then they'd be sent home half a day. And when you're young, you get enthusiastic, and I learned to work four machines. So I found out what they were doing. They were sending these people home and putting me on them. I wasn't as fast as what they were, but I could do the job adequately. And so I realised what he was doing. So I used to say to them, take a part out of the machine. Because all the machines in those days were on lease from what they call the British United Machinery Company. And they'd come out, and after a couple of times, the mechanic would say, where is it? I said, what are you talking about? Where's the part you took out? He knew what was going on. But it was a very difficult period.
Was that to slow it down?
Couldn't operate the machine with a part out. You see, it was all that sort of thing. And the shoes you get today are not what we used to make. They were what they call welt shoes. You'd do the whole box and dice. They'd be stitched on sails, not on these stuck-on things that are today.
And when the people, when the people were sent home, they would be sent home without pay.
Of course. They would pay if they worked an hour, they get paid for the hour, but the rest they wouldn't get paid for that.
That's about 1932, this was.
This was around about 1934 was when I started to work there. Yeah.
Right. Was it unionised then, or?
Pardon?
Was there a union at that?
Oh, yes, there was a union, but it was always smart. You see, they get the unions down. Before the unions had come down, they would make arrangements for them to come down. Either they'd ring the union or the union would call, and all the apprentices would have to go and do all the things that had to be done. They'd take them downstairs, give them a couple of grogs or something, then they'd come up and everything was okay. So there was never any real problem with there. But that's what happened with me, was the fact that I found that what was happening, so I had an argument with the boss, which was very stupid, because the fact of the matter was that he'd come up and he started to stand over me. But we had an old fella there that grew up with him, and I used to have a boy assisting me. He took the boy away to sit down and talk to him or give him a couple of boiled lollies. And I went down and got him and had an argument with him, and I called him an ignorant old bee. So he went down and seen his mate, the boss, and he come up to me and he wouldn't listen to me, so I called him an ignorant old bee, and as a consequence, I was a radical. This is what I was supposed to be. And when I got in 21, they made sure they got rid of me, despite the fact they kept people on who weren't as proficient as what I was at that time. And I left and I got a job on the railway. And I was only on the railway a fortnight, and this was during the war period, and they got a very big order for making the Air Force shoes, and they come up and asked me to go back. But I wasn't going back because it was, you know, the railway was infinitely better.
And what was the name of that company, the shoe company?
McEwan's, matter of fact. They were the original makers of the Dally M football boots and the Don Bradman cricket shoes. But see, all around here, now that park over there now was a great big beautiful park with great big, you know, Moreton Bay fig trees. The other side of the park was a company called Metis that had 2,000 people working there. They used to run a special bus with a little loop line around there. That's how big it was. And of course, with the evolution of time and the new procedures, that finished up going down the park. But over here, the park was owned by a trust. There weren't these flats, they only come later. And that used to be looked after by a chap by the name of McCarthy. And he had beautiful gardens, and you get up there and he caught you mucking about. He wasn't short and giving you a whack across the ear or backs you a bit up the backside. And we had one fella up here, about 4 days up, by the name of Whitty. If he caught you over there, he would do the same sort of thing to you. And Mr. Whitty will always be remembered, to me anyhow, because he's the only fella that I ever seen. He had a monkey on a chain that used to run up the tree. And if you try to get into that place, the monkey would bare his teeth and come charge. It was better than any dog. And this is the whole thing with him. Now, in addition to those sort of things, he had a son. And my father told me, well, he had a number of kids. But this particular fella was what my father said. He was over the park eating plum puddings. They were little tiny little beetles he got on the end of this little bush. And he was taken down to bowl at the nets. And he bowled himself into an Australian cricket team and finished up a big grazier in Mount Gambier in South Australia.
Is that one of his sons?
That was one of his sons, yeah.
Really?
And then, of course, further up the street, because as I tell you about Irish, we had the best Irish jig dancer in the whole of Australia, not New South Wales, by the name of Jackie Minns. He, if you could imagine the amount of gold medals that he won. And these all used to be on a great big piece of velvet. It was unbelievable. We had a very famous journalist up the top of the street by the name of Thatcher. They call him Feet Thatcher because his feet was that big. And he used to write for a paper known as the Labor Daily. And we all always had good footballers around here. And to ensure that one of the local fellas never got off the press, his name was Eddie Root. He kept writing through the football season, through the cricket season, and he ultimately became an international footballer, but he was a very good player. We've had a lot of things around here. We've had famous and infamous people. You probably heard about the Joshua Smith Dobell Prize winning thing. Joshua Smith lived around in Brandlin Street. And then on the other side of the street, the infamous part, was that Darcy Dugan. Darcy Dugan's father used to run a little green grocery shop in Henderson Road.
And did you know Darcy?
Only vaguely. I knew of him, you see. We were rather protected. You see, you say, you know, we never ever got out in terms of mix because they used to make sure that who your company was and what you would do. And if you're there. See, it was very easy. In the real depression, my two brothers, I was still going to school really, and they were out of work, one for 6 years and one for 4 years. And my dad used to always be so proud of them. And it used to upset me because he was saying how good they were, because it was so easy to get into trouble. Economic circumstances forced issues that they couldn't do to eat, and that was the whole thing with it. See, one of the things that you probably won't find, but the Alexandria Town Hall has a tremendous history, which people don't really know. At one stage, the first town hall at Alexandria was built in Henderson Road, which was called North Raglan Street. There was West Raglan Street and North Raglan Street. And what happened there, a chap, you see a street round here by the name of Shirley, built the first town hall for £66. They applied to get a piece of land. But the information that happened there was they weren't to spend more than 2 and 6 pence per week to lease a piece of ground. Now, the thing all started, you see, there was no local government in New South Wales till 1842. And that because they, what they call the Sydney Corporation Act, and they dispersed all local government services in and around the area. But within the Act, there was a clause there that said if there were sufficient people that wanted to get a municipality and there were sufficient numbers, they could apply to the governor and he would grant them a municipality. And this is what happened. First Redfern. And Redfern dispersed the local government things at Redfern, Waterloo and Alexandria, because we're only known as the West Ward of Waterloo. We weren't Alexandria. And then when we finally wanted to get a municipality, Waterloo didn't, they objected, they went to court because we were taking away more than half their ground and three quarters of their revenue. And when it came to an election, they wouldn't give us the rolls. And so they again had a problem. And all these sort of things that happen.
You know, you mentioned before Joshua Smith. Yes. Did you know him?
No, I only knew of him because he was around there in that time. I had an auntie lived opposite him.
Now, going back to your childhood, what are your earliest memories? Say you were born in 1918.
18, yeah.
So you could remember the mid-1920s. And what are your earliest memories?
Well, the thing was that it seemed to be because of the particular people, being mostly of Irish extraction and one thing or another, you always had an affinity, you played with each other. There would be situations where every one of us participated in sport. And that's why I was never very good at school, I only wanted to play sport. You could play any of the three grades of football, rugby league, soccer, Australian rules. And everybody would play cricket. One street would play another street. And sometimes if the team that won batted in the morning wouldn't turn up in the afternoon, so you'd have a punch-up. Now, we never had any money. Over this park over here, the only money that we ever got as children was to get up in the early hours of the morning, go over the park chasing empty beer bottles, for which we got a halfpenny. But if there was only one beer bottle and two kids got there, whoever could fight the best got the bottle.
And what's the name of that park there?
That's Erskineville Park. It was run by a trust. But that oval wasn't always there. The other oval was right down on the other side of Ashmore Street.
Hmm. And so how old were you when you started playing? Well,
doing these sort of things. I reckon from around about seven onwards you went there. Hmm. See, and all these sort of things all become a part of your life. Like, you know, every Sunday, we'd come down to the Grandma and Oval and have a baked dinner. That was all part of the system. The other sort of the thing was, you know, we were never hungry. I wasn't, but there were a lot of people were in these areas, and that's where this community spirit became so good with each other and helping all the time. My wife's mother, every time that they had a baked meal, she cut off a meal to take down the street to a person who very rarely got a real good meal. And so all these things happened.
And how is it that your family, did your father stay in work during the Depression?
Yes, as I say, he was a plumber on the railway and we were never hungry. The only thing that he ever suffered during the Depression period was I used to lose 1 week in nine, and other people lost a lot more than that.
And before, earlier on, you mentioned that he got elected, was that to the state parliament?
Yes, an interesting sort of situation, because when Mackell got the Governor General's job.
What year were we talking about?
Yeah, that would be, he was there, he died in 1949. That would be around about 1945. You see, my father, as I said, was his right hand man down here. Everything around here, go and see Harry Noble. And he'd go and see Mackell, and Mackell would do what he wanted, sort of thing, what he could. He couldn't always be successful. And the most interesting thing that came about was that there were some rather dubious sort of people in a lot of people's minds who wanted Mackell to do something, and he didn't do it. So they run a candidate against him.
And what was it that they wanted him to do?
There was one of their friends was in jail and they wanted to get him into a prison farm, which was a lot easier for him. And Mackell did nothing. So what they did, they got one of the local Irishmen, dressed him up, put a new suit on him, took him up to church every Sunday morning, paraded him in the people, and he cut Mackell's margin nearly in half. So Mikkel panicked and he rang my father and he said, can you see them? And I said, yes. So he went and seen them. And then Mikkel said he couldn't remember. At any rate, he did what they wanted. And of course, they come on side. And when Mikkel went, most of these people, my father worked for him so long, he didn't want to leave the railway. I said, but Dad, you've been doing the work for 30 years. Why wouldn't you want to do it? We'll give you a lift in your salary and your status. And he wasn't interested in status. But he got in at a very, very difficult time because it was during that period when they were knocking down all the houses and that Clive Evatt, he promised them that anybody that left would get back first off. And then when they knocked the house down, got rid of them out the Herne Bay and all those sort of places, they changed their mind to this extent. You couldn't come back to those flats if you had a child under the age of 9. Well, this really upset everybody. And of course, this went, well, we talked about it. At any rate, my father went at the last, but you know, he resisted it right through. And it was an interesting sort of thing. Because in the pre-selection ballot, you only had to win the pre-selection ballot and you were in. He only was in about a fortnight before. When the pre-selection ballot was taken, the returning officer, for some inexplicable reason, says that in the event of a dead...
sorry, I forgot what we were talking about.
Oh, I've lost this off myself too. Now, where do I put that up?
Is that clearer?
Yes, we were talking about the fact that my father and this Fred Green, you know, run a dead heat in that sort of pre-selection ballot. And that's how my father... But my father was too fair dinkum. It wouldn't matter...
Did he lose then, did he?
No, he didn't lose. He died, because he died after 2.5 years. And he was too fair dinkum, because the things that he wasn't successful with him used to worry. He could be 98%, but the two things that didn't want... And in politics, you always get your most difficult jobs from your so-called friends. And if you aren't successful, they say you aren't trying. And of course, what was happening with all these people, I remember one piece at the back here, there was a two-story place. And one person was in it, and the owner wanted to get them out because their daughter was getting married. So they were both friends of my father, and they come round here. He was a local politician and they wanted to get him out and wanted to stop them getting him out. So he suggested, have you ever thought, because it's a two-story place, you might divide it into two flats? So he finished up satisfying both people. And this is what happened with him.
So he won that pre-selection?
He won the pre-selection and he was only there for 2.5 years and he died.
Did he have a heart attack?
Well, it must have been because I like to have a punt, and I was at work, and he rang me at work. He said, I'll ring you in the morning, he said, and I think I've got a good thing for you. And they pulled me out of bed the next morning at 4 o'clock, the time he was dead. He was playing cards with his friends, and he got some sort of attack, and he even walked from the car into the casual thing, but they come out 5 minutes later, he was dead. And you would have had to be in there because both sides of Newtown, the cars, there must have been 150 cars. He was very popular. Mm. Good man.
Yes. And how old was he then?
56.
Oh, that's terrible.
Shocking, yeah.
Mm. Going back to when you were a child, well, your father was a plumber.
Yep.
And what sort of family did your mother come from?
Just an ordinary background family. She originally came from Tasmania and her father was a wharf labourer. And as for the irony of, you know, that people tell you not to drink, he never had a drink or a smoke in his life and he died in his early 50s. Grandfather Noble never had a stinking old pipe out of his mouth and lived till he was 82, just went to bed and passed away. Mm-hmm. It was an interesting situation with my grandfather because he came from England in a place called Halifax and I believe it's the Black Hole of Calcutta. When I was over there, I made inquiry. I said, don't go up there. And he was an engineer. As a matter of fact, there was something in the paper the other day. He was an engineer on that grey cliff, but not when the accident happened, prior to that. And he was a strange little bloke. I don't know how many fights I had with him because he had a little bowler hat and he'd never go out here without a tie and the kids used to sling off at him.
They couldn't do that to my grandfather. And so,
what did they say to him?
Oh, you know, he used to sing, "Adja, badja, where'd you get that stick, silly old bowler hat?" You know, and of course, he never ever swore. The worst words he ever said was "blasted." And when he came out, he finally was an engineer on a boat going up the rivers, and he was up at Maclay River. That's where my grandmother came from. And he was an excellent pianist, and he used to be very popular to go around and play for the people. And so that's the way that went from there. My father was an only child.
And when did the noble family, settle in Copeland Street?
1908.
And so you've got all these stories from your father and your grandfather?
Most of them. But a lot of the back around the history of this, because I was at a meeting around here. You may or may not know, they've got a welfare centre around here named after me. And over the road you see my father's got a reserve, the Cliff Noble Activity Centre. And it was that sort of a situation with it, you know. So I've been lucky because with very limited ability, you see, when I got to be run as an alderman, that was an interesting sort of situation, because in Labor politics, it's a pretty diabolical game. You've got to know how to fight. And I didn't know how to fight initially. And they were having troubles because some of the people that were working for me, they said they were going to work up the ticket. Instead of working from the top to the bottom, they're going to work up. And I was on the bottom of the ticket. And I got them out the house of me, and they said, forget about it. Well, the next time it come around, I got a position on the ticket where I could win. I was number 3 or number 4, you could win for. And then I went down to the council, and I was down there in 1959 when I first went there. And then the second period, around about 1964, I became the Deputy Lord Mayor of Sydney. And then during that period, and later on in the year, Jensen had an extensive tour overseas, and then I got a projection from there. And luckily, because the projection was that there became a vacancy on the milk board for a consumer's representative. And I was at work one day, and the Minister for Agriculture rang me up, and he says, "Could you come down to Parliament House?" I said, "Yes." So I thought he wanted to know about the domain bars. They were doing some work on the domain bars down there. And I rang up the council. I wanted all the information, so I went down. And when I went to Parliament House, there's this fella, Andy Knapp. He only had one leg. He's walking down the stairs with his crutch, and he said, "I've done something without your approval. I hope that you will be happy with it." So I said, "What's that, Mr. Minister?" He said, "I've nominated you as a consumer's representative on the milk board. I hope you'll take it." So I thought, well, it's got to be better than being a clerk on the railway. And so I accepted, and my salary went from that to that, which was... So he said, "Would you like to ring your wife?" So I rang up my wife, and she says, "Oh, another gratis job, I suppose." I said, "No, you can give up work." She said, "You're kidding." And that's how that sort of thing happened. And that's how I was lucky. Now, there was some great hullabaloo, because there was no doubt it was job for the boys. And when I accepted, I come home and I start to think. I said, that chairman of the milk board might want me. So I went down and seen him. I said, "Well, Mr. Ferguson, I don't know whether you know or not, but I've been appointed as a consumer's rep on the milk board. You mightn't like to work with me." And I said, "You got any objections?" He said, "Well, not really. This might alleviate you." So he pulled down, pulled out the drawer, and there was his application to the minister to appoint me. And that's how it come about. So it was rather an interesting sort of situation. He said, "The reason I did it was because I have a great aversion to lots of for public servants." He said, "My philosophy with public servants is to always have them on tap, but never on top." And that's how I became. So, and I was only down there 3 months, and the government changed from Labor to Liberal. And the new minister, rang my boss up. I got a phone call here one Sunday. He said, "They're going to get rid of you." And he said, "You better come in early in the morning." So I went in, and he said, "They're trying to get rid of you because you're only supposed to have the unexpired term of my predecessor, which was 3 months." And he said, "That's not true." you've got an appointment. It's in the Government Gazette for 7 years. So if they've got to put you out, they've got to pay you £35,000. I said, it's all the money in the world. So they didn't do it. But I knew I couldn't get in the superannuation fund, so I went and I took out my own superannuation. And then when I get in near the end of my term, the term was for 7 years, and it was a terrific sort of thing. So near the term, I thought, oh, well, I'm gone this time. The new government, they changed over, and I'm at the races one day, and Bob Askin says to me, Cliff, can I see you? I said, yes, Mr. Premier. He said, I thought you'd like to know I've signed another agreement for another 7-year term for you. So obviously I'd done something right.
So surprising, isn't it?
Well, it was surprising. It was surprising because, why people might cast aspersions on Askin, not to me, because, it was a tremendous scene, but that's the way that it went.
Okay, well, let's go back to the 1920s.
Yeah.
Who were your friends?
Well, everybody in the district within about 3 streets around here. You see, we never had any what you'd call enemies, that sort of thing, because we played together in those days. You'd have all sorts of games. You'd have what we call releasing. We'd pick sides and some would scatter everywhere and you'd give them 5 minutes start and then you'd chase after them and grab them and bring them back and put them in a circle. And then so other kids would come in and release them. So if you weren't there, they'd get out. And then, of course, you play the game called Cocky Lorem. Cocky Lorem was a situation where you again pick sides and it would have one fella who'd be the anchor man up against the wall and you'd have about 6 to 8 kids all with their heads tucked down and you'd go down the back and you had to jump on them and if they collapsed down in the underneath your weight, they'd be a weakie. And so this is the sort of thing that went on. And, of course, again, we played marbles and we played tops and we had a tops where you have a circle and you had to spin a top and if it didn't spin, your top had to go in the middle and they could probably, someone could do it and win them and of course you'd be very upset. And then we had another sort of a very silly game called Tippany. Tippany was you'd get a piece of stick and you'd sharpen both ends of the stick and then you'd have another stick and you'd hit it. And when it got up in the air, you'd whack it and see us, and you'd be doing this all around the streets. There was nothing to it at all, but it was just something to occupy yourself.
What did you do with it?
Just a little thick stick, and just point it in, and you'd hit it. And when it go up in the air, you'd whack it with this thing, and then you'd chase it up and keep chasing it all the way along the line. We used to race what we call boats in the gutter when it rained. There'd always be a stream of thing coming around, and you get a little piece of stick and we'd race boats down to the gutters. And that's one thing again which I should tell you about. The most interesting thing was in 1892 there was a tremendous depression around here and the council was operative then. And from all these streams that I was telling you about, the water going down to Shays Creek, they got the unemployed to build what they call canals. Now that took all the storm water around here. A lot of kids got drowned and had, in all sorts of trouble. And then as with time progressed, they used to race boats down there. And this was they'd bet on them. And depending on the volume of the water and the width of the stream, you'd have either 6 or 8 boats. And they'd give all various prices of them, and people have their pennies and threepennies on them, whatever it might be.
Adults then?
Oh, mostly adults, not the kids. The kids come into it later for the simple reason. On the side there'd be a lot of green moss and that sort of thing. And the bookmakers used to say to the kids, if the favourite's in front, if you fall in the stream, there's threepence in it for you. So you'd fall in the stream and the boat was leading, you'd get washed on the side and they would lose their money. And of course we'd get the threepence and away you'd go because threepence was a fortune. I've just got to go somewhere up here. And, of course, what happened there was a granddaddy of all fights at that particular time because the people from Newtown used to run it and the people from Alexandria weren't very impressed with that, so there's only one way that they could, get to charge of it, and so there was a big punch-up. And then they'd play 2-up and all that sort of thing over there.
So there was a punch-up between the people from Alexandria.
Alexandria, yeah. The play from Newtown. Yeah, oh yes, that was on, you know.
Did you see that?
Oh yes, I've seen several times. And it might be a grandstand view because there was a big water pipe went right across. We used to sit up there and watch it. We would never get involved because we're too young. The only thing that we ever got was when we fell in the stream was a big kick up the pants or a whack across the ear from the people in back, the boats that went up on the side.
Can you name, like, say, some of the people that were involved in that? Do you know the names of the local
characters? No, I wouldn't know them now because it's a long time ago. It's a hell of a long time ago.
What about the names of the kids that you used to do the boat races with and play with? What were the names of some of them?
Well, as I say, there was this Jackie Minns. I always felt sorry for him because he used to have to go to school and he was that good. He used to have to teach Irish dancing and his mother was a bit of a tyrant with him, and one thing, or we thought she was. And then there was a chap at the back by the name of Crane, who at one time was a deputy town clerk of Alexandria Council. We grew up. And this Billy Timms was a nephew of the Minns, Billy Timms was a nephew of the Whitties. He became a draftsman. And we were always pretty good, but and good friends, that sort of thing. But a lot of people wouldn't do because, see, years ago, unless you were prepared to do some silly things like, well, break windows or break the, they used to have the, you know, the glasses for the lights in the street. Kids used to get a fiendish delight out of doing that. And, of course, in the real bad times of depression, they only ever used gas around here, and you had gas meters and you had a penny in the slot or a shilling in the slot. And if people seen the people going out and they thought there was an opportunity, they'd get a tin opener and they would open up the things and they would knock the money off.
So in the area there was a bit of petty crime?
But economic circumstance, I didn't call it crime because I believe that, you know, circumstances force people to do things that they normally wouldn't do. It's just like policies. I used to be in a position when I was on the milk board, we used to be part of making a policy. Now, policies are made at particular times to meet a need at that time, and that you shouldn't be stuck with them forever. Now, I firmly believe that if you're going to make a policy that's going to interfere with the lives and the livelihoods of people, you should go and tell them the reasons for it. Now, we used to do that by going out to the farmers, and it was very difficult to police farmers because unless you gave them what they want, you were always wrong. And we never done anything for them. We only done things to them. But I adopted an attitude with them that sometimes the sourest medicine affects the greatest cure. So you tell them the nasty things. They want to kill you and all that sort of thing. But then they later on, they realise that what you're trying to do is for their advantage. And that's the whole thing with them. Now, what I used to do as a consumer's representative, I had 3 million bosses in New South Wales. I've been called every kind of illegitimate there ever was because I wouldn't always agree with what they wanted to do. And, of course, everybody likes to hear things pleasing to their ears. Now, I used to tell them if I was talking to a group of farmers, I said, look, I can stand up here tonight and I can tell you all the things that you want to hear, but they won't be truthful. In a month's time, you'll realise what a villain I was because you'll suffer the consequences. You having trouble?
What I wanted to ask, you know, we're talking about the kids in the neighbourhood and the people that you knew. Much earlier, you mentioned the McMahons who had the stables. Now, did you know Billy McMahon? I believe he...
No. He was on the opposite side. We only knew of him as a treasurer, and he was a very good treasurer too, despite what people think, because he was a subject of a lot of ridicule because of his appearance and one thing and another. But that did not, you know, I don't think affected his ability to do the job properly.
Did you know him as a kid?
No, he didn't live around here. Only Buddy McMahon, his uncle, was that bloke up there at Western Whitsun.
And did you know him?
No, he was a much older vintage than me. But why I knew about him, because I went to the brother's school up there at Redfern, and his stables were just opposite where we were.
What was the name of that school you went to?
The Patrician Brothers Redfern.
And tell me about that school.
Well, it was an interesting thing. I started up here at the convent, up here in Erskineville Road there.
What's it called?
At St Mary's Erskineville. So I went there, and I can remember my first day when I went there, very resplendent, and I can always remember Sister Augusta saying, "Was your brother named Philip Noble?" And I very proudly said, "Yes." She said he was a monster, and she never, ever got off my back. And in those days, the nuns used to have a great strap around them to get reached the floor, and she wasn't adverse to using it. So she made my life rather difficult. And I can always remember I was appalled. I was having difficulties doing long divisions of money. And they got a lay teacher come along and spent more time than she should have with me, but she taught me what to do. And I did it. And very proudly, she gave me some exercises to do, and I took them over. And she looked at it and she threw it at me. I said, "What's the matter?" She said, "Yeah," and put the pound shells and pence on top of them. So I answered the door one day, and the brother said to me, he came down, he said, "How about coming up to the Patrician Brothers at Redfern?" I said, "No, I'm happy up here," because to me, the nuns were the quintessence of everything that was good. I still practice by faith, and I believe in it, and I reckon they were the ones who really started me off. So he said, "Why won't you come on? Can you play football?" As soon as he said that, I was gone. I said, "Yes, I can play football." And away we went up there. Now, we used to scale the trams, and that we used to walk most of the time. But they made a tremendous impact on us, because only as late as last Saturday night, I went to a reunion at Harley Cross College Ride where they had the inner city boys there, because there were three schools. There was Redfern, Waterloo, Mount Carmel, and Forest Lodge. Well, most of the boys, they all come down, started at Redfern. They used to come from the western suburbs all down here and go there, and of course, it's all closed now, that part of it. But, and of course, football, that was, you know, this is it. And I took them some photos over and showed them the photos. 60 years ago, we were virtually unbeaten. We used to beat the public schools. And one of my greatest joys was playing on the cricket ground before the English people. And I got a number on me back. I was made because I was big time with this number on me back. And so it went on. And from that time, there were seven of us that was played in that football team who all played first grade football.
What team?
I played with Newdown. I had one season with South, not very good, but I was at Newdown. And I can always remember my swan song as a footballer. It was during the war, and those austerity Saturdays, there was about 40,000 people out there. And I'm walking off the ground with a compound fracture on this jaw, a broken on this side, and a bloke with the biggest voice screamed out, "What's the matter with you, Noble, you mug?" And so this is what went on. But they were good times and good football, that sort of thing.
And what the Patrician Brothers school, what was it like going to school there?
It was good. It was a bit hard. People, you know, I'm not very partial to this non-corporal punishment in schools today, because of, the economic circumstances of our school, a lot of kids done a lot of things that they shouldn't do. I remember on one occasion I'm sitting in the class there, and in come a policeman, and he said, "I want you." And I said, "Me?" He said, "No, that bloke sitting alongside you." He'd been down. In those days, the toilet systems used to have a great leather outlet. You'd have the bowl up the top, and you pull the chain, and the water would come down. There's, again, this sort of lead outlet, and he was pinching the lead and selling it. And I nearly died. Thought it was me he was talking about. But they were all sorts of people. And one fellow that went to our school, his name was Penrose. He was the greatest villain of all time and ultimately got shot. It was only at the school half the year, and he was the best student in the class. In our intermediate, he got six A's without any trouble at all. Everybody was battling on. And they finally, he was allegedly, I don't know that this is, but allegedly the only fella that ever broke into Orchards and Jewellers in the city. And he was coming home, and the policeman up there, the tram used to run along Redford Street, and the policeman must have identified him. And he finished up, he shot the policeman, and they finished up shooting him. And the brother told me, he's allegedly, according to the police, he shot himself. He said, well, he must have been good. He had about four bullets in him. But see, there was a mixture of both. But I subscribe to the fact that there are a lot more good people than the ones that aren't so good. So I don't worry about the ones that aren't so good and concentrate my efforts on the people who deserve to be looked after.
And were you a wild kid?
Not particularly, because I was lucky. I had two brothers who could protect me if I got into any trouble. But I don't think that I was wild, because I was always fearful. On one occasion, I remember my auntie lived up at Redfern, took me down to the markets, and she wanted 2 shillings worth of oranges. And while I'm there, the biggest orange ever seen was in the front. And when the bloke turned his back, I picked it up and put it under my jumper, and I'm walking away. He said, hey! And I pelleted back at him. He said, I've only given you a shilling's worth of oranges instead of two. When I got back to my auntie, I was deathly white. And she said, what's the matter? You sick? I said, sick for fear. And that's what went on. So I learned, there's a couple of things I learned in life. That, you know, stealing's no good. And I've never had a draw of a cigarette in my life. And the reason's why. And I've never had a drink in my life. You know, despite the fact I've played football. And I was always popular because I could drive them home and that sort of thing. And I got more abuse from barmaids because they wouldn't have a man's drink and all that sort of silly business. But the smoking bit, they used to have a factory down here in Newton Street called Manly Ferrari, and they used to make cane perambulators, and they used to have little offcuts of cane which they threw over into the paddock. And us boys, I was about 9, I think, we went down to have a big go at this smoking business. The first 2 kids that lit up, one went green and got very sick, the other bloke got yellow and got very sick, and me being a coward, I said, not bloody likely. I never had a draw of a cigarette since.
Were they smoking the cane?
Smoking the cane, because I used to smoke anything.
Yeah.
Tea leaves and all those kids and that sort of thing. But it just never appealed to me. I thought it was the most stupid exercise I've ever seen in my life, smoking.
Kids do in the depression, did you in the depression sort of have to do things to help supplement the family's income?
No, I didn't, but we used to all have little jobs like running that, taking that, the orders from the butcher around to people and that sort of thing. You'd get sixpence. My mainstay of sixpence a week was my grandmother, who was very sick for years, and I can always remember in that front room, she had all holes in her legs. She had dropsy, and they used to drill little holes, and all used to be weeping all the time. So I used to get sixpence a week for running her messages, which was big time. You can get in the pictures and all that sort of thing. But it was just something that you took for granted, you know. And the basic thing is you were never jealous of anybody because you were all in the same boat.
And did you go to the pictures? What did you do with the
pictures? Oh, yeah. Up at the sixpence, you'd pay threepence in, and then you'd have threepence worth of lollies, and lots of times you'd have the things, that little round balls that you'd let them run down the thing and upset. And of course, the pitchers in those days, they used to have a person playing the piano all the time, and you know, the dreary dramatic scenes that all this crescendo would get up, and so it went on.
It wasn't silent movies, was it?
Most of the time, yeah. Oh, of course, and when the talkies come in, that day come in around about 1928, 29. That was fantastic. And same with the wireless. We used to have what they call a crystal set. And used to have these little ears. And of course, we only had one set of earphones. And of course, 3 boys all tried to get a go at these sort of things. They were pushing and shoving and all that sort of business. But I would say I've been terribly lucky in my life. Let me tell you this, as I say, with very little ability. I've had 2 trips around the world. One, I took a delegation from the city council around the world. The second, I went to an international milk conference over in Austria. And these are the sort of things, and while they're good to see, it's lovely to be home. But I've learned in life that if you want to get something, you've got to impose something on people, you've got to do it by going and fronting up and explaining to them. Because whether we admit it or not, we're all creatures of habit. And unless you explain it to them, you have a corollary of 4 things. Fear, suspicion, prejudice, rejection, and that's how they come in all this order. So it mightn't be as nice as what you want, but you've got to be prepared to do those sort of things. It was very interesting. So I keep wondering, but when I got the job, you know, there was quite a hullabaloo because top public servants wanted the job and my boss didn't want public servants. People in the Labor Party weren't very happy. I remember the secretary of the Labor Party saying to me, "That's the best bloody kept secret." I said, "It's a secret for me because I never had a clue what it was all about." And they get very, very jealous about these sort of things. And when I got the job, there was quite a hullabaloo in the paper about the fact that, you know, jobs for the boys. And someone was maligning me. What does he know about production and distribution of milk? And poor old Rex Jackson, who's had all sorts of trouble, Rex got up, he said he knows all about the stuff. He drinks the bloody stuff. That's how he knows all about it. And so it went on. And these are the sort of things that happen with you.
Yeah.
Yeah, so.
You know how before, this is just going back.
Yeah.
Bringing back, you know how you talked about the Syrian area?
Yes.
Where was that? We didn't say where that was.
That was on the other side of Redfern Oval. You know, down there, I think this down there, what they call, not a, there's Chalmers Street and there's Elizabeth Street. Right down the back there, probably be what they call Elizabeth Street. And we used to go down there and cause all sorts of mayhem by ridiculing them. And sometimes they'd pull out a big knife. When you seen the knife, you were wham and away you went for your life.
And what did you say to them?
We used to think, "What are you wearing a dress for?" Because we couldn't understand all this sort of things that went on. And it was very interesting too, because I remember when I was the alderman from Redfern constituency got ill. And I said, "Well, look, I'll do your interviews for you." And I went up and I set myself up there. And a fella come in one night and he says, "I believe that you've opposed the granting of an application for me to set up a factory." I said, "That's right." He said, "Why?" I said, "Well, I think there's sufficient factories in the area that's, you know, getting all this rag trade, because all those Syrians and that were all rag trade business." He said, "Well, I made this application at the request of the alderman who was here, should be here tonight." I said, "Well, I didn't know that." So I went and seen him. So I then said, "Well," got to talk to him. I said, "You go back and appeal against the decision and then I will get up and speak for you." And then lo and behold, he pops up and he said, "I went to school with you." I said, "Well, I don't ever remember you," because he was a lot younger than I was. And we got very good friends, you know. And it was an interesting exercise because in that time, Nick Shahady was around, you know, Sir Nicholas. And that in the Lebanese community.
Interview with Cliff Noble, 3rd of November, 1994. What were we
doing? Yeah, about the election, when these the Lebanese had met and they said they were going to support Shahady. And this friend said to me, he said, "No, we're not. We're supporting Noble." They said, "All right, we'll support Noble 1 and Shahady 2. And that's how, you know, I never had any trouble at all getting back into this sort of thing. But it's an interesting, people are very critical of local government, but they do more to develop areas than anybody, and particularly this area around here. It was unbelievable. Because, you see, one of the things, when they started in 1868, now they had people who had never had a clue what they had to do. The roads up here, the main roads, were just sand tracks and impassable in the wet weather, dust bowls in the dry weather, and so they had to get themselves all re-educated about what had to be done. Now, there was a toll road up here in Mitchell Road, there was a toll road in Botany Road, and there was a toll road in Henderson Road. Henderson Road is a very interesting thing because, and most of those aldermen, one of them had 34 and a half years service in the council, as much as 25 years, 15 years, and so it went on. And right opposite Alexandria School, where there's a local pub there now called La Balaclava, that was known as Jessen Village, because all the huts around here were just slab huts. And this Mr. Jessen, created what they called Jessen Village, and he was the first man to introduce good houses for the people in the area. His own was like a castle with a British flag floating on the top and everything else.
When was that that you're talking
about? Oh, this is way right back in the 1860s onwards, you know, around about 1880 and that sort of thing.
And how do you know about this? Have you been studying?
Well, I done some research, and as I say, this Rotary Club, they wanted me to talk to them. And I only for the reason, the fact I'm probably one of the oldest people living in the area and lived the longest here. And I seen it as a challenge, so I started to, you know, delve into it. And I thought to myself, this is unbelievable, and this is a thing that, the more I thought about it, the more interested I become, because it really conveyed man's inhumanity to man. Now, history is made by incidents or achievements. Now, I was reading recently, like, when Cook come out here in the 1770s, and which what upsets me now, he stuck a flag in the ground over there at Kurnell, and that was a symbol that stood there for 18 years to indicate that this was a British possession. And he only beat La Perouse, Captain La Perouse, a Frenchman, by a fortnight. Otherwise, a fortnight, we would have been French. So when Philip came out here, and when he's made this awful statement about desolation, he's only there a couple of days, and he come down through and got into the heads. And the whole perspective changed. So when they first come out here, it was Banks who seen the potential for Australia. And what the incident that created and advanced our population or our, you know, inhabitation by 50 years was when the Americans threw the tea in the Boston Harbour. They had to find places to put them. And Banks come up and said, Australia. But do you know what they did with those poor people that was coming out to be our inhabitants? They were loaded on ships in January and were down in the holds of the ship from January to May. Never got to see the sunlight in there.
Okay.
And this is what goes on.
Yep. Okay, that's good. I mean, you've done quite a lot of work, haven't you?
Yeah, yes. Because it becomes very interesting.
Yes. I want to get back to Nick Shahady. Did you know him as a kid?
No, I knew him as well. Nick Shahady was the son of an Archbishop of the Greek Church up in Redfern, and was a great friend. His father was a great friend of McKill, who was a local member up there. And I remember having arguments with him down. Well, not arguments. He was a great big giant. I said, you've got to learn to fight. You're too easy. You can't have these blokes having a go at you. You know, you want to do the nice thing.
Who's this Nick?
I said to Nick, because I liked him. And his wife was a doctor, Marie, a very nice person. And the thing, he did learn to fight. And so it went on. But I said, your father be turned in his grave that you're an anti-Labor bloke now, because his father was a great support of the Labor Party.
Mm. Okay, now let's get back to the childhood. What sort of a neighbourhood was it here?
Well, it's a very poor neighbourhood, as I've told you earlier. Like, nobody had anything, but that was the whole thing. Now, Parentia, just give you an example, that if somebody died around here, you'd answer a knock at the door. No one could ever afford to buy a wreath. They'd come around and collect pennies and halfpennies and threepence to buy a wreath, just to make sure that they were part of that particular thing. And this is why I say, like, if you were sick, they'd come down, they'd do the work for the people, and away you'd go, because you never knew when it was your turn. But it was a poor neighbourhood. Now, as I told you, I was the last of three boys. Everything that I got was hand-me-downs. My little short pants were more patches than what they were pants. And then if they were too big, the stock answer was, well, you grow into them. And these are the sort of things that happen.
Did your mother work?
No. That was all taboo in those days.
Can you describe your mother's day at home? What you can remember?
Well, first of all, she had to get up around about 6, and she'd prepare the breakfast so that my father would get his first, and he would go off to work, and then she'd have to get us up, make sure that you washed yourself and cleaned your teeth and had your breakfast, and away you went to school.
Was it a cooked breakfast?
Oh, very rarely. No, very rarely. You only, got... evening meal was the only time you ever got a cooked breakfast. Well, the only time... or cooked in the meal. But, for instance, now everybody has cereals and things. We would have bread and milk. they would chop up clunks of bread and they put warm milk over the top of it. Then you'd have a bit of toast. And sometimes you might get an egg, sometimes. And you'd use treacle in those days, or jam on your toast. But lots of times you never used butter and treacle or butter and jam. You had one or the other.
What about the evening meal? What was that like?
Well, the evening meal was the usual sort of thing. It would probably be meat and vegetables, and probably most of the time would be a custard, like a tapioca custard or a rice custard, and so it went on. And sometimes you would have fruit salad and stuff like that. The high days and all those sort of things was Easter and Christmas time, where you'd have chook and pork. But the other time was the cheaper cuts of meat.
Like lamb chops or...
Oh, yeah, or sausages, anything. And I can remember if my mother would have been out and come up, like, she used to prepare a thing called dry ash. People wouldn't know. Dry ash consisted of buying a bit of cooked corned beef and the thing, mashed potatoes, put it all up, plonk. And then when they wanted to fill you up, they would make what they called dumplings. Dumplings was a concoction made out of flour and water with treacle over the top of it. And when it hits you and got down in your stomach, it'd be there for 2 days digesting, so you were always full. Mm-hmm.
And didn't your home life, what was that like? How did your parents get on?
Well, they got on reasonably well. I think that they married very young. That was one of the big problems of that sort of thing. And of course, it's like everything else, familiarity breeds contempt, I think, over a period of time. And they done all right up to a point, I guess.
And towards you, would you say that, were they warm towards you?
I was in an interesting situation. When my brother was born, my first brother, my grandmother took absolute control of him, much to the disgust of my mother. They never, ever got on.
Is that your father's mother took
control? Yeah, my father's mother. Then my second brother come along and my mother said, well, they're not going to do that again. So he became her favourite. And so when I come along, I got the best of both worlds. I get a bit off both of them. And I can always remember when I lived up the top of the street here, one birthday, they both bought me a pair of shoes for my birthday. And when I took my grandmother's pair up, my mother says, take them back, we don't want them. So I took them back. And what did my grandmother said? Well, if you're going to send them back, send the one I bought, not the rubbish he bought. So it went on. My grandmother was very, very skillful with the needle. She made dresses for all the high people in Sydney, and that was where she was. And she was very lucky.
Was she a professional tailor?
A dressmaker, more than a yes. And I say, the people that she made dresses for, she had a very good association, so much so that one of the big people in Sydney, who was evidently a professional punter and that sort of thing, told her, he said, Mrs. Noble, for the next 12 months, you put your shillings and your 2 shillings away, because I'm going to give you a horse that'll win the Melbourne Cup. And it did. And she was done that for what's her name? She had a lot of jewellery. I've got a piece in there, a tie pin that had a great big stem on it. It's made in the form of a shamrock, and it's got a diamond in the centre of it. She bought one of the famous jockeys here who went broke. She bought all his jewellery. But she was a pretty difficult sort of woman, I would say, particularly from my mother's point of view.
Was her husband alive?
Yes, he outlived her by a good number of years. That was my grandfather. Yeah. He was very good, as I say, never used a bad word.
And where did your grandmother, what was her name?
Her maiden name?
No.
Her name was Georgina Noble. Well, we still have a Georgina, one of my brother's children.
And what was her maiden name?
Stanford.
Georgina
Stanford. They come from up the Clay River.
Right. And where did she have her dressmaking business?
From the home here.
Oh, and this is her home?
Yeah, this is her home, yeah.
And so you live... We're in number 25, Copeland.
25 and 26, because I am constantly being plagued by real estate agents who want to buy it, because we've got usually double the frontage of what the other people is. My grandmother bought this. They lived at Darlington at the time, and this area was supposed to be going to be the shopping centre of Newtown. And so that's how she came to buy this here, and it just didn't eventuate.
Right. And so how far up did you and your parents live? What number did you live at?
We lived at number 4.
Right.
Yeah.
And your parents were both Catholic?
No, my father wasn't, and I don't think a better man ever breathed, because his philosophy was the woman bears the children, she does the rearing of the children, so she should have the say in the religion. And us boys all were brought up as Catholics, but my two other brothers, my older brothers, never continued on their Catholic education like me. I went from the nuns to the brothers, and they went from the nuns to the public school.
Mm. And what church did you attend?
Up here, St Mary's Erskineville.
Who was the priest up there?
The greatest character that ever breathed, a fellow by the name of Dr. Toomey. An absolute mad Irishman. He was one of 14. He had two pet aversions, the Masons and abortion. And he used to have the big pulpit, and he'd get up there, and I can still see him. His neck would come up like a frilled lizard, and if he happened to be under the pulpit, he'd get covered in spittle. And he rang that thing, he says, the bloody murderers, and what was going on. He was an institution around here, both as a man and a priest. Everybody loved him. He used to walk up to him and say in his office every night, and all the kids said, got a penny, Doc? And he'd throw it out, didn't matter who they were. And he'd done all the things that you believed in. He was a terrible skite. He used to come over here and, you know, do athletics and that sort of thing. And I can remember we were kids, we were doing what they call a Eucharistic Congress over in the old Oval. And the two of the worst villains in the area were kicking a soccer football in amongst us. So they come over here, he just got out his knife, ripped up the soccer ball with his knife and went back and threw these things. They were great big mountains and bad men. But he would do that. And then he'd come down there, go and ask your brother, can I take you out for a swim? And we'd all get into a little T-model pod and we'd go out. And he's the type of man he was. In the First World War, they were talking about voting for conscription. And he said, up in the pulpit, he says, I'm not telling you to vote against conscription, but what I am telling you, that anyone votes for it, don't come to confession for absolution, because you won't get it. And this was the sort of fellow that he was. And we used to have a picnic from up at that convent every year over to Clifton Gardens. And we're over there, and someone went and told him some fellow was interfering with the girls. Well, he went down, he gave the bloke a hiding. He dragged him across the area, took him out on the wharf, and he says, now, get the next ferry or I won't be responsible for my actions. He walked back down the jetty for about 20 yards, and it got the better. He went back and picked up the bloke and threw him in the harbour. This was the man that he was. he was that strange. And, of course, when my brothers went to the public school up here, he said from the pulpit one Sunday, any Catholic kiddie that's not going to the convent will not participate in the races. Only that. So, okay. My eldest brother was evidently fleet of foot, and we had a fella over here who was a great footballer of South Sydney named Pat Murphy. And he wanted to back my brother to win the race. So he goes up and said, hey, Doc, you said the kids not going to the Catholic school can't complete in the races. He said, did I say that, Pat? And Pat says, yeah. And he said, I bloody well meant it too. This was what he was all about. He left here, he fed half the area in the Depression. He was a great man. And
what years was he here, just to...
Well, I'm talking about in my era, that would have been around about 24 from there on. See, I'd have been about six or something going up there then. And he was just an absolute marvellous man. He left here and went out to Dulwich Hill. Of course, when he got to Dulwich Hill, he wasn't averse to saying what he felt. It was the Christmas period. And when I worked on the railway, we had a fellow by the name of McGee down there who was a very smart economicist or whatever they call him. So Doc got up and said, now it's a Christmas time, it's a season of goodwill, and Arthur Furlong has got all the goodwill up there in the corner pub. And of course, Frank McGee goes around and said, hey Doc, yes Frank, what can I do for you? He said, I wasn't very pleased with your sermon this morning encouraging people to drink. He said, Frank, you're an economist, aren't you? He said, yeah. Did ever I tell you how to run your business? Don't bloody well tell me how to run mine. Get out. And this was the man that he was.
So he was in the... He was obviously in the area from...
Yes.
Well before when you remember. You
know? Well, that's right. Long before.
And right up until... When did he go to Dulwich
Hill? I would say that probably in the late 30s or early 40s went to Dulwich Hill.
I know. What about the... just thinking of local sort of authority figures, what about the police? Did you know them?
Well, the only time that ever I got into, well, not trouble, I was playing football and someone had walked on my foot and the dye from my sock got in my toes and I got a poisoned toe. And I'm up there at Newtown. I used to have late shopping nights up there. And I'm talking to a couple of fellas and they just walked away. I thought, what the hell's going on here? At any rate, these two cops come down and they said to me, what are you laughing at? I said, I'm not laughing at anything. And they whirl around, grab me by the shirt and says, where do you live? I said, Alexandria. Where do you live? I said, Alexandria. And they start calling me names. What's your address? Where do you work? I said, down at McEwen's. Do you work down McEwen's? Oh, there. Well, on your way, son, because we used to make their boots down there. they had to be tough. I can't say that I'm opposed to them, but they just never, ever use much finesse in the things that they do. And still aren't, you see.
And can you remember any stories or, you know, like you personally mightn't have had any trouble, but, or even good things about them?
Well, we had a very tough, stupid person here who come from up at Newtown. His name was Apo. Leo, I don't know that Leo, but he's Apo. And from the time he was about 12, he used to frequent the billiard parlours and pools, whatever they call them. And at that stage, he was very good. And at the age of 12, he got in an argument and he tipped the sea. You know the billiard cut. He got a heavy end and a finny end. He whacked the bloke on the head with it. And that was his first start off. Well, then he became an absolute madman. He would, if you was up the pub having a drink, he'd think nothing of grabbing you and throwing you out, would try and pick it up. So he had a fight with a chap named Casey, and Casey was able to beat him. And then for the next month, he's sitting outside of his place waiting for him to come out so he could continue on with the fight. And he finally ran into poor old Casey, who had a broken arm. He said, I can't fight. He said, I've got a broken arm. He says, good, and he's into him. And then a chap I went to school with by the name of Jackie Crimmins. He was a pretty good street fighter and what have you. And this Apo picked him one day. He said, how good are you, Jack? He said, oh, I don't know. There's only one way to find out, isn't there? So they went out, he said, and they had a fight. And he said, he was giving me some. And he said, he rushed me and we fell over backwards. And his nose and his mouth hit the gutter. And he said, you have never seen so much blood in all your life. And still want to continue on the fight. So there's a classic example of no brain, no pain. Mm. A bad man. Mm. But
why was it that there seemed to be so much fighting?
It was just a manifestation, I suppose, of manhood. They'd get drunk. And just another thing about him, I had a cousin that was in the police force. He was 6'4". I used to be about as far as his noble. And he, we come a policeman up there, and we used to have a cop around here by the name of Long Tack Sam. You've probably heard about Long Tack Sam. He was a very courageous bloke. Now, every Saturday afternoon up there at Erskineville, there'd be a fight or something. And most of the police used to walk down. When they seen the fight, they'd turn back and go up, but not him. He went right down and he'd start to clean them up. Well, evidently this Apo was playing up, and my cousin was working with this Long Tack Sam up at Newtown. And as soon as he seen him, he took off, and Long Tack Sam says, keep running, Jack. I only want an excuse to shoot you. And he said he stopped there like a sphinx. You couldn't shift him with a crane. But these are the sort of things. They're all parts of characters of people. And ultimately he got into trouble, Long Tack Sam himself.
When you think back about those days, say in the 20s and 30s, is it a positive sort of feel?
Well, I think it was. And I think it was... today I have an aversion when I see people taking kids to school in cars. Now, I know there might be some reason for it, but to me, the only chance you've got to develop your own character is to get out of that cocoon of protection within your home. You've got to mix with other people. You've got to understand what's going on. Because what happens when you leave school and go out into the great big world? You haven't got your parents there to tell you what to do, how to do it. And I think this is where it's starting to break down.
And people, when they walk to school, they talk to everybody. Is that
talk to everybody, that's right. And you know, some people you'd like, some you wouldn't like, and so it went on.
I'm just thinking, who were your immediate neighbours in this area here? And where did most people work?
Well, as I say, growing up, we knew everybody. I wouldn't know. I know the people alongside me here. I know the Greeks, but I wouldn't know anybody from there on up.
When you were a kid, though?
When I was a kid, yes. There was a, of course, this was the whole thing. The Whitties had a big family. We had a people named Corliss that lived next door to us. They were great Irish people. And then we had the group next to them. That's an interesting thing. By people by the name of Kerrish. When they lived in Alexandria, their name was Kerrish. When they moved to Mortdale, they became Kerrush. And this was happened when I went to a 21st birthday party. I'm introducing this Gordon Kerrish to my wife. He says, Kerrush, if you don't mind, Cliff. Now, that's an interesting sort of thing because he finished up a very senior position in the Commonwealth Bank. His brother has commanded a ship in the Second World War. He was, and he went to Alexandria School. He was a very bright person, the ducks of the school around there. And he went from here, was a great hullabaloo when he came because he went from here down to Jervis Bay in a naval sort of a scholarship, and that's how he became to be a commander. Now, from him then, of course, you had the parts of the Whitty family. I can remember my brother when he got married. He came home, he was sick, and he had quinsy. He dropped from 14 stone down to 9 stone. They brought the new baby home, and my father and I were walking up and down. The baby's crying, a place down. We didn't know how to keep her quiet. Poor old Mrs. Whitty come down. She said, "You having a bit of trouble?" I said, "Oh, God." So she just got the bunny rug, wrapped it around the kid, put it back in the thing, and never heard another word about it. And so it went on. And
was it mostly Anglo sort of community? Were you
Irish
here?
Yeah, Irish. Yeah, mostly Anglican and Irish. See, and even another thing, that just reminds me, there was a place just the other side of those flats, because where those flats are up there, that's where the Whitties lived. And there's a fella named Mickey O'Dowd, and of course they went down and they were pinching the vegetables from the Chinese, and they had a blunderbuss, and bang, it went. It was a series of pellets, and whacked him in the backside, in the back, couldn't kill you. And we were sitting up there over a bucket of hot water, picking the pellets out with a needle. That's the only time I ever heard of that. Then, of course, there was the Minzes, and so it went on. Oh, no, they were all pretty friendly, like in this street here. And so even down further, there was that sort of thing. But, you know, it was one of the sort of things that there was compatibility and friendship with people. Nobody was just looking out for themselves all the time.
Hmm. Was it a safe neighbourhood?
I would say yes, because now I've been burgled 5 times, and the first time it started is when I became an alderman. Up till then, you see, and they never ever got anything. That's the whole thing with it. They would have had to put it here to get anything. But it's that devastation of coming home and finding it. The only thing that I ever regretted, my father used to have one of those gull watches, and I had it there, and they pinched that. And when they caught the kid was 16, and his father was keeping it for him out there. And I said, "Well, look, I'm not worried about it, but what about the watch?" And he said, "I sold it," because he didn't know where he sold it to. That was really a bit disturbing to me.
But when you were a child in the 20s and 30s, wouldn't you say it was a safe neighbourhood?
I would say so. You see, because there was never any ever thing to worry you about any of that sort of business. And if there was, you know, a problem, and it would sometimes happen that if the, you know, the husband was building somebody up, his wife particularly, they would find an excuse down the pub to sort him out, some people.
Would they?
Yeah, they would do that.
How do you know that?
Because I know that that's what would do. They would pick a fight over some consequential thing and let him have a go. It's the same as, I just tell you this story, you probably might think this is not true, but Mrs. O'Reilly down here rang up the parish priest and she says to him, "Father, will you come down?" He said, "Why can't you come up?" She said, "I'm not going to go out." She said, "Oh, I'm in a bit of a mess." So she went down, he went down to see Mrs. O'Reilly, knocked on the door, and when he opened the door, her face was all bruised and her lip was cut and everything. He said, "He's done that." He said, "Pat, he's coming home drunk every night. And this is what, if I say to him, let's cut it out, he just assaults me." So this is what happened. So he said, "Will you talk to him, Father?" And of course, a priest talking to an Irishman was like talking to God. He just said,
is that, Doc Toomey?
No, this was another priest at the time. Doc was here, but there was another priest there. And what happened with him was that and he said, OK, I'll talk to him. So a couple of nights later, Pat's coming down the thing, and of course he's full. And he's singing our battle hymn, Faith of Our Fathers, as he's walking down the street and he's carrying on. So the priest said, hey, Father, Pat, I want to see you. He said, that's funny, Father, I want to see you. So Father said, what's that all about, Pat? He says, well, Pat, he said, I want to see you. But before he could say a word, Pat said, Father, what's fibrositis? And the priest said, oh, here's an opportunity. He said, fibrositis is a very, very painful disease, Pat. He says, and what happens, people who drink excessively, bash their wives up and carry on with other women are usually the ones who suffer the worst. And Pat started laughing. He said, what are you laughing at, Pat? He said, I read in the paper where His Holiness the Pope is confined to bed with fibrositis. So it goes on. But no, I've never had any desire to leave here. I've been very happy.
When you were a kid, did you roam far?
No. The worst things that we done was go up there, you see, Sydney Park. You see, around about 1892, Brickfield Hill was where they used to make all the bricks. And they finally found good clay deposits up here at St Peter's, and that was the top. But it was a difficulty getting up because of the sand and the things that happened. So when they took the clay all out, they left great big holes. And that's where we learnt to swim. We would go up. A hell of a lot of kids got drowned up there. There was something there and at a place over here just at the back of Waterloo, nearly into Rosebery there, called Burroughs Welcome. They used to make all the chemicals and various medicines. We used to swim in there, and of course you got a mouthful, you're sick for a month. And when the police come, you used to grab your pants. You always used to swim in the roar and that sort of thing. And you're running off with your pants saying everybody's screaming out at you. But these were the sort of things that happened.
Was it very polluted?
Oh, yes, over there at Burroughs Welcome it was. Well, up here it was mostly only mud and clay, the residual runoff and that sort of thing. It wasn't bad.
But what did you swim in at Burroughs Welcome?
At Burroughs Welcome was a great big pit. It was just as deep as what these sandy the brick pits up here were.
How did the hole get there? What was that from?
Well, they obviously must have done it, got the clay out over there, because, you see, all those were sand hills. And they used to, you know, sell the sand for all constructional purposes. The same as Alexandria Park there. I don't know whether you've seen that. Alexandria Park was known as Mount Horn. And that was a sand hill. And they used to sell the sand from there. And then it became a tip. And then when the council started to get a go on, they started to do certain works, put gardens there. Of course, they run out of money. And the only way that they could keep the flowers watered was the bloke was given a barter system. He could graze his cattle there, six cows, from 6 o'clock in the morning to 6 o'clock in the morning, providing he watered the flowers. Well, see, even Alexandria Town Hall, when it first got built around there, someone tried to burn it down.
Why?
Don't know. But see, these are all the things that the books that don't tell you. Because I suppose they think it's an indictment on the area or something.
And how do you know about these things?
This is where I've read about all these sort of things, you see. Because in this place that they had built the town hall around in Henderson Road, they stayed there for 10 years. And it was only from 1928 that they really started to improve the town hall. Now, that town hall was used as a temporary school. It was used as a temporary hospital during the bubonic plague in 1918. It was also used as in what today the entertainment centres, because there was always dances and things of that nature there. And it's a pity because, you know, that has the real history of Alexandria. Mm. And now there's nothing.
Okay.
I'll give you a big hide now, haven't I? You go home with cauliflower ears.
Thank you very much.
That's okay.